So the thing I'm going to talk about today is some work that I've done along with some Christoph Schamutis and Gustav Niz and Tony Padilla, who are also in Nottingham as well. And it's about the extra mode that appears that we just heard about from Petter. And in particular, we're going to ask how this mode behaves and how it couples to things like matter. And the upshot is that there's potentially a strong coupling issue with this mode. So that's what I want to discuss. Now, there have been a few kind of mumblings and rumblings about the way we go to do our calculations. So what I want to do for the first part of the talk is just take through a tour of the technique involved in this calculation. So what I want to do is go through some examples where you can use this technique in more familiar settings, and we'll see how it works there. Then when we come to discussing it in the picture of gravity we've just been hearing about, hopefully when we an alien construction. So it'd be fairly simple tour, starting off with massive photons using a standard techniques to understand what the degrees of freedom are doing, and then using the technique that we use for understanding the non-relativistic gravity, which is this Stuckelberg, or so-called Stuckelberg trick. And I think one of the names may be part of the reason for some of the mumblings. It's not really a trick. It's a perfectly valid procedure. It's a nice technique to extract the degrees of freedom and see what they're doing. So you can see this fairly nicely in the massive photons. Now, massive gravity is a well-studied theory, and it has a lot of similarities to the Hilbert gravity that I'm going to get onto. So I want to spend a bit of time seeing how massive gravity fits into this calculation using the Stuckelberg technique. Alright, so first of all then, so a massive photon. So the simplest Lagrangian that you write down for massive photon, and you have standard kinetic term for the photon, plus some self-interaction term, which is the A mu A mu term. So this is there just to give the mass for the photon. So it's quite a simple minded model. But you see explicitly straight away, you've broken gauge invariance that you would expect to have for a massless vector bulb. So it's pretty simple to vary the Lagrangian, find the equations of motion, and what you find is that your electroconstraint condition here, to d mu, a mu, are vanishing. So if you have non-zero m, you find something which looks like the Lorentz condition that you might impose if you had massless gauge bosons. But here it comes out as a constraint from the equations of motion on top of what looks like a standard kind of massive equation. But it's important to realise that the origin of this term is very different from the origin in the usual case for gauge invariance. So this is coming out as a constraint equation from the equation of motion. So this is a nice linear system which makes it easy to solve. In particular, what you can do, you can look at the individual nodes, you pick a particular wavelength and ask how does that behave. So it's nice and linear, so we can find a nice easy solution for a single wavelength or wave number k, substitute this into the equations of motion, find the dispersion relation, which corresponds fairly simply to sort of massive particle you expect for a relativistic spectrum as well. Now, the next step to analyse this is, instead of thinking about this vector in terms of the index mu, it's more convenient to think about it in terms of polarization states. So the standard analysis says that you introduce a set of polarization vectors. So these are four vectors which are complete and orthonormal. And the idea is to replace this index mu by this polarization index lambda, and then study the degrees of freedom in terms of polarizations rather than the mu index. So there's one example of a set you can take. Particularly nice because it has these, two of these vectors are transverse, so these ones will turn out to be related to the physical degrees of freedom, and you have a time-like and longitudinal polarization vector. vectors are just one choice, but then it makes it sort of fairly clear what the physical degrees of freedom are in terms of polarization.
From Maxwell's proper theory, which is the law doesn't propagate, it's just algebraic.
I guess we'll kind of come to that.
Okay.
So you convert these indices mu from into the polarization indices, and this constraint equation that came from the equation of motion relates the two polarization states, the alpha 0 to longitudinal to the time-like motion. Okay, leaving you with the three degrees of freedom. So you get the two transverse and one longitudinal degree of freedom. Now thinking about the massless case, so we're going to switch off this M parameter and take us to the more standard thing that we're familiar with, which is the electromagnetism of a massless vector boson. And now we do pick up the standard gauge symmetry. So the vector A mu can do a standard gauge transformation. And if we impose the Lorentz gauge condition that came as a constraint in the massive case, that's not enough to completely fix this gauge symmetry. You can still do a shift by a harmonic lambda, so a space-time harmonic, and then fixing that gauge symmetry, the residual gauge symmetry, means that you can actually fix the longitudinal component up to zero, leaving you with the two standard transverse degrees of freedom for a massless vector particle. So this is kind of what you get in the standard case. Now this is where you see the difference between the massive and the massless case. In the massive case, we have no gauge symmetry leading to 3 degrees of freedom. In the massless case, we have an extra gauge symmetry which suddenly appears when the M parameter goes to zero. So no matter how small M is, the gauge symmetry only appears when M equals zero. So you have this discrete jump going from 3 to 2 degrees of freedom. Now, the idea of the Stuckelberg technique is to get rid of this jump as you go from the massive to the massless case. And the origin of the jump is just because for zero mass you have a symmetry, and for non-zero mass you don't have a symmetry. So the idea is to introduce or enforce a symmetry even for non-zero values of the parameter n. So we want to take this action here, which is kind of clearly not got a gauge symmetry, and we want to impose the gauge symmetry on it. So this is done by figuring out what the gauge symmetry is at m equals zero, and explicitly putting in by hand this redefinition of the vector field based on the symmetry that you want to impose, that you want to appear at the massless level. Okay, so phi is going to be our new scalar field. This is the Stuckelberg scalar. And we simply insert this definition, this redefinition of the field, into the Lagrangian that we have, and write down what we get. So what you find is the standard kinetic term that you expect for a vector particle, the canonical kinetic term for the scalar, the Stuckelberg scalar. You still have the mass term for the vector, but you now have an interaction between the vector and the scalar. And by construction, you now have a manifest gauge symmetry, even though the M parameter is non-zero. So the gauge symmetry that you introduce is a shift in A, at the same time you shift in phi as well. So this is there for all values of M. In particular, this is going to make the massless limit smooth. You don't suddenly pick up a new gauge symmetry. Symmetry is there for all values of the parameter M. Now, there's a few points which are worth noticing. In particular, if you take phi equal to zero, you simply recover the original Lagrangian, so that's just a gauge choice where you choose lambda to be essentially given by phi, and then you just recover where you started with, so that's the gauge choice you could make. Second point is that because we have the standard abelian gauge symmetry for A, this A that appears in this Lagrangian here has 2 transverse degrees of freedom, just as it did in the massless case. So going from the what we see then is that this scale of phi should now actually be identified with the longitudinal mode of the massive vector that we had before. So this Lagrangian that we've got, A has got 2 degrees of freedom, just as you'd expect for a standard vector particle. And you've effectively extracted out the longitudinal mode from the vector of the massive case. And the reason for doing that is that it's this scale of degree of freedom that's going to be playing a crucial role when we think about the strong coupling. So this technique is useful because it explicitly extracts out that degree of freedom. Instead of having it buried inside the vector, it's there right in front of you in the Lagrangian, and you can understand what its interactions are doing. So what else can you do? You can take the massive limit fairly easily. If you take the massive limit, m goes to zero, these last two terms just drop out, and you're left with simply the kinetic terms. And so you can see explicitly in the massless limit, all that's happening is you're not losing a degree of freedom. It's just simply that the degrees of freedom stop talking to each other. They're no longer coupled together. So there's a smooth massless limit.
Smooth in what sense? I mean, you have an extra degree of freedom. If I had a thermal state, I would have more entropy, for instance. So it's not the same.
But it's smooth in the sense, you always have the 3 degrees of freedom. There's always 2 in the vector and 1 in the scale, for whatever value of m.
Yeah, but the last degree of freedom is no longer observable. It's an empty point, like the empty point universe. Because it's decoupled from accuracy.
Yeah.
So it doesn't make any difference. You can always add to any theory any number of degrees of freedom which you don't observe.
Yeah, it's just these don't talk to each other anymore. So.
Another way of saying this is you do a Hamilton Dirac and Strait analysis, the maximum proper, and find that the longitudinal degree terms of the property. It's a straightforward calculation. It's equivalent to that.
Right, I mean, you can see,
let's say everything's coupled to gravity, and I have
I haven't got
cosmology.
I don't have gravity here. There's no
five particles.
There's no G mu nu here. I haven't got it. I mean, there is G mu nu. It's not dynamical in this picture. I mean, they could talk to each other if you had another field which coupled to both of them, which is what gravity would do. But I haven't got that in this picture.
But there is a point that this is not the original AMU that's decoupled, it's this redefined AMU that's
decoupled. Sure, yeah. But all I'm saying is that this AMU here is like, in some sense, a standard AMU, because it has 2 degrees of freedom. So in some sense, this is a natural formulation.
Can I just ask, if the A had been coupled to charged matter?
I'm going
to
do that now. Okay, so that's just been preempted. The things change slightly if you try to couple this field to a current, to other types of matter, so if it's charged. So the standard coupling would be to take this A mu and let it talk to some current J mu. This again doesn't have an explicit gauge symmetry because of the mass term. Nevertheless, we can impose the gauge symmetry using the Stuckelberg technique, asking what gauge symmetry we want to have, and then inserting a scalar field in order to explicitly have that gauge symmetry. Okay, so this is just the redefinition that we had in the previous transparency. And you're left then with the theory that contains standard Kent terms as before, but now you also have this coupling of the Stuckelberg scalar to the current. And this is what potentially causes the problem in the massless limit. You can see that the M parameter appears in the denominator. So if you try to take the massless limit in here, you see that the Stuckelberg scalar is coupling very strongly to the current. Now, if this current is conserved, then it doesn't actually cause a problem. The reason being, you can do an integration by parts, and then you've got B mu, J mu vanishing, and so this term isn't actually present. And normally, the conservation of the current is a consequence, or a constraint from the gauge symmetry of the original action. In this setup, there's no reason for J mu to be conserved, but if you do couple it to a conserved current, then again, this term wouldn't be there, and you can take a smooth massless limit. So this, when we look at the gravity case, the analog of the conserved current is going to be a conserved stress tensor. So you might, again, naively think if you couple the couple gravity to a conserved stress tensor and try to take the analog of this m going to zero limit, then you might be safe. And we'll see that that's sort of half true, but half not true as well. Okay, so what I want to do now is to move on to gravity vector. And starting off with GR, you do a think about the perturbative limit of GR in terms of the graviton, so G mu nu goes to H mu nu plus H mu nu. You get a kinetic term for the graviton piece coming from the Riemann scalar. And it's coupled to the stress tensor T mu nu. But we want to introduce a mass term. So this is a mass term called the Pauli-Beertz mass term. Its form is fixed by considering things like ghosts. For the purpose of this talk, that's not important. But what's important is that there is a mass term that you can add to the Lagrangian when this is the form it takes. So in this case, the number of degrees of freedom changes. In the massless case, you have the two finalization states for the graviton. In the massive case, that's increased actually to 5. It turns out the equation to motion of the form d nu h mu nu goes like d nu h. So that's one of the constraint equations that come down to the equation to motion. And you also have the h goes like t. So there are 4 conditions here, which actually take you down from 10 objects inside h mu nu to 5. So these are 5 degrees of freedom you have in h mu nu in the massive case. Now this doesn't have the gauge symmetry that you would expect in the massless case, or you have in the massless case. So this is at the linear level the analog of the 4D diffeomorphism invariance. In terms of this, you have just think of it as a gauge symmetry. This is a gauge transfer. So this theta nu is just some 4 vector with 4 independent space-time components. And it's not a symmetry of this action if this mass term is present. But if we want to go through the same analysis as you do for the vector case, you want to be able to consider the massless limit of this theory where you have 2 degrees of freedom. So you want to know how these 5 turn into 2. You go through the same process and you impose this gauge symmetry as being a symmetry on the action by introducing a Stueckelberg vector this time as well as a Stueckelberg scalar. So this is the form, the field redefinition that you take in order to get something that's manifestly invariant under this gauge symmetry. So when you do, I've missed off some terms here proportional to m and m squared. Just forgot them when I was typing them. So there are a couple of terms here. That's not really important what I'm going to say. The point is what you end up with is what you have in the massless limit. So this is like the standard GR pieces. You have a standard kinetic term for the vector, so the Stueckelberg vector. You have something which doesn't quite look like a canonical kinetic term, but if you redefine to another field redefinition on H, then you can turn this into something that's more recognizable as a kinetic term. The cost of doing that is that you lose the minimal coupling to the stress tensor, but again, that's not really important for what I've got to say. Having done that, you then have manifest gauge symmetries that you set out to impose at the start. You have the sort of diffeomorphism type symmetry, gauge symmetry that you wanted in the gravity sector. You also pick up the gauge symmetry for this Stueckelberg vector. So what this first one means is that the graviton H mu nu has 2 degrees of freedom that you normally have for the graviton. So in some sense, again, this formulation, this is the natural formulation to think about the graviton. It has 2 degrees of freedom that you would normally expect a graviton to have. This vector, because it has an abelian gauge symmetry, again, you have reduces the 4 degrees of the 4 kind of components in mu down to 2 degrees of freedom. So you have 2 transverse degrees of freedom in this vector here, A. So again, in some sense, that's a standard vector, 2 degrees of freedom. And finally, you have the Sokolberg scalar, phi. Well, yeah, phi hidden here. So that's the fifth degree of freedom that you have in the massive graviton. So again, what you've done is you've been able to extract out all the relevant degrees of freedom that were buried inside H mu nu. You've pulled them all out. You've explicitly written them out on the page in front of you. It's got a vector degree of freedom and a scalar degree of freedom. Now, when I've written this term down, what I've actually implicitly done is assumed that T mu nu is conserved, and what that has meant is that there are no 1 over m terms appearing in this Lagrangian, apart from the m squared pieces that I forgot to write on. What happened is you take the mass limit, you get precisely this equation here. So there are no 1 over m terms. So again, there's a smooth limit of m going to 0. So, at first sight, it appears that you've got a sensible way of taking the massless limit. If you couple it to a conserved source, you don't seem to get strong coupling. The difference is that now we know that gravity is not a linear theory. This is just an approximation to a whole series of terms. And in the nonlinear completion of whatever this theory is, although we don't know, there's no unit.
So, doesn't phi have a kinetic term?
Well, it's sort of. If you do, there's some redefinitions of H that you can do to get this into.
Isn't it just the perturbations in metric? So there is an actual eta mu nu.
There is an eta mu nu. Well, yeah, so when you raise these indices here, you're raising them with an eta.
Maybe you've left out the phi then? That looks like
a. No, I don't think so. No. Because there's a redefinition of H that you do. I can't remember what it is, but it involves a phi. So the redefinition of H goes to H plus phi something, and so you get a quadratic phi piece coming out. The price you pay is so you lose this minimal coupling to matter. I think this is.
It's this, that second term, if you integrate by parts, it's obviously phi times the Ricci scale term. Mm-hmm. So you could easily get, you do H mu with H mu plus e to mu phi.
Right, that's fine.
That gets rid of it, and then you get a kinetic.
Any other points? Right. So yeah. This is just the quadratic term of some full nonlinear theory of gravity. We don't know what the nonlinear completion is. Nevertheless, you can speculate as to what kind of terms may appear. So a possible term that may appear in the action before you Stuckelberg is something which looks like H cubed. And that h cubed term, when you Stuckelberg, so when you introduce h goes to h plus vector plus scalar, that's going to introduce pieces that look like this. So d squared phi cubed when you Stuckelberg the h. So this is a term that's going to be in the nonlinear completion, or could be in the nonlinear completion. And by choice, we've canonically normalized phi, so you can straight away read off that there's a new scale here. This is the Feinstein scale, and this is a scale at which the theory becomes strongly coupled. So at any scales above this, the theory is strongly coupled, and you need to rethink your degrees of freedom. Okay, any questions on that?
So in what sense is it then a rewriting of the original theory of the Masters theory, in the same sense that question was asked before. Now you have gravity present, and you don't even have a minimal coupling between the diagonal.
No, this is scalar. Massive gravity is a different theory to GI, and you only know it in the sort of quadratic limit. Really, the nonlinear completion it's a lot of gravity, isn't it? There's no unique nonlinear completion.
In all these examples, the problem is not in the theory itself, but in the Stuckelberger description. This description has problem and breakdown, but the theory itself.
You don't know what the theory is. Well, you only know the quadratic.
Yeah, but I mean, for example, the massive vector field theory. I think it is still well defined, although.
Sure.
Yeah. So that's what I mean. I mean, then the The original theory has no problem. Only the Stokes description breaks down.
No. I mean, you need to talk about when you want to quantize it. For example, you need to talk about. You need to know what these perturbations are going to do, the quantum fluctuations. You need to know how they're going to behave.
Okay.
And this is what it does, right? This gives you the scale at which those perturbations are going to cause the problem.
If you quantize, don't you get ghosts?
No, there are no ghosts. In which one? The gravity one. The Fitts-Pauli term is chosen to have this form so that you don't have ghosts. I mean, in principle, you can have an independent parameter for each of these pieces, but to eliminate ghosts, it takes this form. If you don't have that form, then this Stuckelberg scalar essentially ends up looking like containing a ghost. Okay, so hopefully, kind of given some idea of why you want to look at this Stuckelberg technique. It's just a technique of extracting out the degrees of freedom associated with having fewer symmetries in the problem. Okay? So in the case of the non-relativistic gravity, you have fewer diffeomorphism symmetry, and the Stuckelberg procedure is going to let you extract out what those degrees of freedom are doing. So the approach of I guess we probably think about this in different ways, but the approach, the way I've been thinking about the non-relativistic version of gravity is you start off with thinking about space-time, and in space-time you can still do a foliation of the space. You pick some spatial surfaces, and you decide to describe your space-time in terms of those. And there's a natural, so that means you can write the metric in a particular form with a lapse function, a shift vector, and a spatial metric gamma. This, in and of itself, doesn't actually break 4D diffeomorphisms because you can choose these surfaces to essentially be any surfaces you like, any spatial surfaces you like. And the diffeomorphism symmetry, at least at the linear level, is just telling you how these different functions, the lapse shift and the gamma, change when you do these diffeomorphisms. So choosing this ADM slicing doesn't in itself get rid of diffeomorphisms, but the next step does, and what the next step is to say that you do have some preferred spatial foliation, and those foliations are going to be invariant only under recurrent variations by a function of time. So you still allow the full three-dimensional diffeomorphisms function of space and time, but the time ones only by a function of time. So, in terms of constructing the theory, what you then need to ask is what objects do I have that are covariant under this three D diffeomorphisms that I'm allowing in the theory? And there are a few terms that you can write down, or a few sort of classes of terms that you can write down. And the sort of things that are covariant under the 3D diffeomorphisms are things like the Ricci curvature, or the Riemann curvature on the 3D space, extended curvature, the gradient of the lapse. So we're going to hear, I think we're going to hear more about this term from Diego Blas in his talk. This term turned out to be important in the strong coupling analysis. I'm not going to have much to say about this, so I don't want to preempt the talk. So these are the kind of terms you're allowed in your action. The form of the kinetic term that we heard about in the previous talk is going to be a gamma of dot. We only want these to be at most gamma dot squared in order to avoid ghosts who don't have a higher derivative, kinetic high derivative, time derivatives. So in our action, although in principle you could have all of these things to any combination, we're going to restrict the KRJs to be squared. And that was, apart from that, we'll add anything else.
Well, so this by definition means that you're not looking at the minimal model where n would only be a function of time.
Oh, yes, no, that's right, I'm not.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite an important point. Yeah, so in this, don't say explicitly, but in this I'm thinking about the lattice function here is being explicitly a function of C and X. Okay, so you can take this construction of slicing up space into the spatial slices and ask, what does GL look like when I do this? And the answer is it looks like this. You have a kinetic term for the metric. So remember, K is essentially gamma dot. So this is like a gamma dot squared term. You need the K so that it's covariant under the 3D diffeomorphisms. And the potential term is the Ricci scalar of the three-dimensional surfaces. So in order to that we want to then extend this, because we don't have 4D diffeomorphisms anymore, we want to impose quite such a strong condition. And so we can add these extra terms. We're only allowing ourselves to be quadratic in K, so the kinetic piece can only pick up a K squared term, and we preface it with a 1 minus lambda, so lambda equals 1 is required to get GR back. But in terms of the potential, you can in principle add any of these kind of objects. Now, I'm not really going to restrict the potential other than to say there won't be these grad log n terms. I think we can hear more about these in the subsequent talk. So in principle, the potential I'm talking about is any function of R and grad R. Okay, so that's the geometry taken care of. We need to know how to put matter into this model. Now, I'm not going to give any special form of matter. I'm going to leave this completely general in the sense that I'm just going to write down the action being Sn. But it's convenient to introduce some quantities associated with a stress tensor. So the stress tensor is usually the variation of the matter action with respect to the metric. The metric is now written in terms of these laps and shifts and gamma rj's, so it's convenient just to introduce these objects. But apart from that, I'm not going to say any more about the content of mass. That's not going to be important. Nevertheless, there is you can make some statements about what's going on in the matter sector. So, for example, if you have 4D diffeomorphisms, you can see that you end up with conservation of the stress tensor. Because we're not imposing the full 4D diffeomorphism invariants anymore, this is a slightly weaker condition. Because one of the conditions, one of the diffeomorphisms, is that we're going to allow t to change by another function of t, no more a function of space as well, which means that one of these conditions, conservation conditions, is actually an integral constraint rather than a local condition. So unless you specify more what your matter actually is, there's not much more you can say about it other than this. So we're not really going to need any of that. So we've got the geometry, we've got the matter. We now need to decide what background we're going to perturb around. So there's a choice to make here. And so the choice that we made is something that we considered to be natural at the time for a background, and the background we chose was that it was static. So effectively, the extrinsic curve should vanish. And we're going to say that our background solution, all the matter, is switched off. And to make our lives simpler, we can choose a background gauge where we need to shift X vanishes. Okay, so that's the choice that we wanted to make. Maybe there are other backgrounds which are more natural. This background is certainly a solution of the theory, and it's something that we consider to be a natural choice.
Hold on, I missed the transition there. So now you want to consider linearized theory around some background.
Yes.
And you're just choosing a simple background to start with.
Yeah, so we want to know what the modes are going to be doing. Essentially, we're doing a perturbative level, so we're going to look at the action, look at the quadratic action, and ask what the modes are doing at that level.
I actually have a follow-up question to what Ben just asked. Wouldn't it be sensible to start expanding around a ground state solution? So you want to identify the correct ground state first, or expanding around some generic solution?
This includes Minkowski space, which is certainly a solution. Right? The question of, I don't have anything to say about the other ground states. I mean, one comment I would make, I'm not sure where Diego is, but possibly in his talk, he's going to extend this analysis to more general backgrounds, which include some spatial length scale and time length scales. And if you repeat the analysis, and actually makes the conclusion slightly stronger. For this point, I'm just going to. Okay, so just to remind you that the action that we've got is, we're going to think about it for the GR action, the matter action, plus these kind of UV, if you like, these UV terms, for the correction to the aesthetic piece plus the potential piece. And we're going to want to know what the modes are doing at the determinative level. So we can take this action and look at its quadratic form when we do the perturbations in the lattice, the shift and the gamma. So these little ends is the perturbed lattice and shift, and H is the perturbed gamma. In fact, for our purposes, we're only really interested in this kinetic piece, the K squared, so I'm not really going to say anything about potential, but we're not having these graphs log n terms. Okay, so this is what you get when you look at the quadratic action. And, well, this quadratic action, because of the presence of these pieces here, they don't have the diffeomorphism, the 4D diffeomorphism that you have in standard GR. And just as in with the massive vector case and the massive gravity case, we want to impose that symmetry in order to extract out the degrees of freedom. Just to remind you, this is what we had for the diffeomorphisms, the 4D diffeomorphisms, and on our background, they simplify significantly. So these are the 4D diffeomorphisms to impose as a quadratic action. And so to do that, you redefine your H and your N and your lattice N to introduce the Zuckerberg scale of phi. You can also introduce the Zuckerberg psi. But this psi, when you do this field redefinition, doesn't appear precisely because this psi is associated with a 3D diffeomorphism. And the theory is manifestly invariant under that. So the only new terms that appear are the ones with the Zuckerberg scalar phi. And so this is the action that you get when you do that. You see that the Zuckerberg scalar appears, so this is the thing, the degree of freedom that's kind of explicitly extracted from that was buried inside the H and the U. It's convenient to do a rescaling to get rid of the constants in front of the quadratic gradient pieces. And when you do that, you can see explicitly what's going to happen when you try to take the GR limit. So remember, the GR limit is lambda going to 1. This piece up here, it doesn't cause any problems when lambda goes to 1, but you're coupling to matter, which is this rho dot piece here, the coupling to matter does cause a problem because the 1 minus lambda is in the denominator. Now, if you choose to couple it to conserved matter, the same reason when you couple the massive photon to a conserved current, actually this term disappears. This is just the conservation of energy. So you can get rid of this piece if you couple it to a conserved matter source. What you can't get rid of is these nonlinear terms here. And these nonlinear terms come from, where are we? These nonlinear terms come from the k squared piece. So we only expanded k squared to quadratic order. But you can see from the definition of k that, for example, you have the lattice function sitting on the denominator. So when you perturb the lattice, you don't have arbitrary powers of this perturbed n in the original formulation before you do the Zuckerberg. So when you do the Zuckerberging, you change n to include the Zuckerberg scalar, what you'll find is that you get arbitrary powers of the Zuckerberg scalar phi, prefaced by this 1 minus lambda. So when you canonically normalize, the 1 minus lambda become turn onto the denominator. So the lambda going to 1 limit then becomes problematic, and you pick up strong.
You're not going to actually show what those things are.
Well, you can kind of guess. Well, you can do it. It's not a question of, okay, it's not really a guess. You have an explicit expression for K here. So you can write them down. And you can just stick this expansion into K and calculate K squared and get it. I mean, you calculate precisely what they are. The only thing that's really important is that you have arbitrary powers of n, arbitrarily 5 powers of this n, really, which when you Stuckelberg gets 5 powers of phi, which when you normalize, you get the lambda on the bottom. Okay, I mean, all these in principle you can kind of write down. Okay, so this actually leads you to a strong coupling scale, and you can read off the strong coupling scale from the coupling to matter. It just turns out to be Planck mass with the 1 minus lambda, stroke to 1 minus lambda. So this, for energy scales above this, then the theory is strongly coupled. So in the GR limit, everything above zero is strongly coupled. And
so here you assume you couple to some matter content so that the matter is non-trivial, but the energy density is identically zero, the total energy density.
In the vacuum, that was the vacuum choice.
Yeah. So the matter here is only vacuum fluctuation, or it has really some
essentially just perturbing around Minkowski space. Just the flat background. And you're asking, well, what do the gravitational fluctuations behave like on that background? And what happens is that they're strongly coupled on this energy scale, above this energy scale. So in the GR limit, this energy scale goes to zero, so everything above zero is strongly coupled. And as I say, these
sorry, one more question. So then it seems that the energy momentum tensor should be renormalized to zero, if it is really like
this.
This
actually doesn't, the strong coupling, although I've kind of highlighted this term here, which is coupled to the matter, you can't get rid of these nonlinear terms. These nonlinear terms, even if you sort out your matter set, and you can get rid of this completely if you say your matter is conserved. So that term isn't really important. The important point is that it's a nonlinear completion. The same as the massive GR, the nonlinear completion is what gives you the Weinstein scale, the strong coupling scale.
Yes, what I mean is that there is two choices. One is that you insist that this is vacuum, so you need to renormalize the energy momentum tensor so that it is really zero. And another choice is that you don't insist it is vacuum so that it is no longer Minkowski background.
But you can't even renormalize. What this strong coupling is saying is that these H mu nu variables are no good. They're strongly coupled. You can't even start with those to do your renormalization scheme.
I think you're talking about theory with space-dependent Laplace function.
Yeah, that's what we
And if, I mean, in the case that the Laplace function is a function of time only, then you don't have a coupling.
Sure, sure. I mean, that's what I said earlier. This is specifically for Laplace depending on space and time.
I make another comment. So this phi doesn't really have a kinetic there.
Okay, I'll address that.
I have a general question. To what extent do we need the Stuckelberg formalism for this? Because in some sense, if you look at the nearest spectrum, you get the extra scalar mode, and we know that as you approach lambda equal to 1, the kinetic term becomes degenerate. So isn't that the same?
Yeah, I mean,
if you wanted to canonically normalize that field, then of course you would pick up all the 1 over lambda minus 1. And multiplicative factors in all the nonlinear terms of how that field couples to itself or the rest of the system.
Well, I mean, the chronically normalizing thing is just a rescaling of the field, so there's nothing, there's no physics in doing that, right?
In some sense, it's
it just makes it easier.
Telling
you
what kind of a Gaussian fixed point I'm using to actually.
It's just a rescaling by constant, so hold on, by now. So I don't have any physics in that. But what you're saying about why you want to use Stuckelberg, it's just because you've found explicitly zero degrees of freedom in a simple way. It's no. You can do like in the massive vector case. You can do the analysis without Stuckelberg. Stuckelberg makes it a lot clearer, I think, what's going on.
Phi doesn't have a kinetic term, as I said earlier.
Yeah,
that's a coupling key.
Yeah, I was going to address that now.
Okay, so physically, what's it coupling to?
Well, so it's all about coupling. Okay, so that's. So this is just a comment about curvature GR being experimentally quite good. The final sort of things I wanted to go into, I'm not going to go into this in any detail because I think Diego will probably talk about this when he gives his talk. But there's a nice way you can, so what I've been talking about is getting 4D digital morphisms at a perturbative level by introducing this triple work scale perturbatively. You can do it non-perturbatively by essentially starting off with your non-relativistic action, and wherever you see a 3D Riemann curvature, for example, you replace it by a projected 4D Riemann curvature, that's stuff. And the projection operator is defined by the special surfaces, the preferred foliation. Preferred foliations are then level sets of some scale of phi, and you define nu as then the normal to those level sets. And so that defines the projection operator. And you can then explicitly write your theory in terms of mu's and nu's rather than i's and j's. So this was done by Gimani and company and by Blatt and Sam. And you can then recover the original action by a particular gauge box that requires t. So the point is then, yeah, so you end up with a Lagrangian which is kind of explicitly written in terms of mu's and nu's. Okay, so to address so the work that Diego did, which was very nice, and they extended the idea of just expanding around the flat background that we did, and they introduced some kind of thing that you were talking about, some sort of length scale on the background, and some sort of time scale associated with the background. And if they say that that length scale is L, what you find when you go through and perturb this, Stuckelberg scale that you've introduced that defines your foliation surface, what you find is that actually you do generate a kinetic term for that piece. And it's only precisely in the limit where the background is flat that you have that kinetic term disappears. But it does propagate on a more general background. And in fact, when you do the analysis, they argue actually that the strong coupling scale isn't the one that we identified because it's lambda naive, but in fact, lambda naive divided by L. So when you take large L, so for homogeneous spaces, strong coupling scale actually comes down even lower by this factor of L. But I'm not going to talk about that in any more detail. But the recent work that Diego has been involved in is introducing these grad n terms into the potential. And it seems that what happens is you can lift that energy scale from potentially zero to a higher level. As far as I understand, that energy scale is always there, but you can lift it high enough to be phenomenologically viable. But nevertheless, it is still there at some high energy scale. So above that energy scale, you still need to rethink what your variables are. And in that sense, kind of back to the GR case, where above some energy scale, you need to rethink what happens to the gravity field.
So I think just having a kinetic term doesn't mean that something is dynamical.
I think I'll probably leave that to Jay. I don't know where it was.
Theorized more.
Okay. I think it'll probably address that. I mean, this is really their work than mine.
I just want to make that comment.
Okay.
Just have to be carried out, I mean, the action doesn't make sense.
Sure.
So I guess the other way of saying that, that's not a kinetic term, right? Because
there's
no momentum going on. I mean, there's no, the momentum is not an integer.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so just summarizing the first few points have already been, the first point is from Peter's talk. The second point about Lorentz invariance wasn't really raised, but the issue is if you have more time derivatives than sort of phi double dot, then you naturally introduce ghosts. So that's why we have only k squared as being the upper amount of k in our action. This idea of losing, you never had Lorentz invariance, but in the sense that you don't have as much diffeomorphism as GR, introduces this extra degree of freedom. And this extra degree of freedom, you can see through this analysis, becomes strongly coupled at some energy scale. So there is still work that's ongoing by Diego in trying to lift this energy scale, but as far as I understand it, it's kind of always there. So this is something that still needs to be addressed. Okay, thank you.
18 years ago, I published papers in which spontaneously violated the vacuum standard. And what happens is that it only happens at the back energy. So you go through a phase transition just below the prime energy, and you get back the resonant waves and diffusion models and all that. So this is a different way of doing it. And when you do that, you avoid potentially a lot of this trouble at lower energies for obvious reasons.
So, do you have a UV complete theory? You're saying you have a UV complete theory? Is that
I think so.
Okay, right.
As I worked out, that this was republished with Selectra stuff last May. So, let me remind the people here that no one has ever observed Lorentz violation up to the prime energy. And it's still questionable whether it's violated at the prime energy. This is experimental fact.
Sure, yeah. I don't think that contradicts anything.
Incidentally, 18 years ago, it was very unpopular to do this.
It's not at all, but it's very popular.
And now I'm sitting in a workshop where everybody's doing it. I just want to put things in perspective.
Are there any other questions?
So I guess my point is that, although it may seem that there is an actual degree of freedom at the perturbative level around any homogeneous background, we don't see it. So it might be just that that's not really a degree of freedom, it's fully constrained by your boundary conditions. And in that case, then there is no constraint from test of gravity on it, because it's not really a degree of freedom.
I'm not sure if that. Okay, I mean, that may be true, but I'm not sure if I think these problems still appear through couplings of other modes to this, and then...
Maybe, but that needs to be demonstrated.
No, sure, I agree. This is kind of the first step to show that there are impossible problems with strong couplings.
So the thing that our concept, say, a scalar tensor theory, is that like you showed the pulsar constraint. They are things that you actually propagate, and those are very much constrained.
Sure.
But this one, it's not as this obvious that it does propagate.
And I'm not making any claims that this is this is where we stop. All I'm saying is highlighting a potential problem that needs to do a full analysis. For example, the pulsar calculation, that is supposed to actually be done, right? And we'll certainly have them done. All I'm saying is that GL works very well for that.
I'm a little bit confused because the point of Sliverwolf was to clearly identify this degree of freedom, but you haven't got its kinetic term.
I haven't, but I think
so.
Well, it does identify what's going on. This is an extra mode that is potentially there, and you don't know what it's going to do.
It's the same mode that you see in the linear Linearized approximation without using the Schlitterberg trick, right?
Yeah.
You just look at an extra mode which has a specific dispersion relation, and we saw that actually becomes singular as you take lambda to 1.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's no physics in doing this Schlitterberg trick. It just
doesn't seem to help.
Well, it's
because you haven't got the kinetic term yet.
Mm-hmm. I have one comment about what was just mentioned about potentially killing this degree of freedom. I'm very sympathetic to that idea in principle. I don't really know how to make it work, but I want to point out
tomorrow.
Sure, no, I look forward to it, and I just want to point out that there is actually one good example in quantum gravity where something like that happens, where you look at topologically massive gravity in 2+1 dimensions, which naively has this scalar physical polarization that formally propagates. But the way people have been able to make sense of the path integral in 2+1 dimensions with negative lambda for topologically massive gravity led to the chiral theory of gravity in 2+1 dimensions, which has no propagating degrees of freedom. And the scalar is actually killed consistently, precisely by the boundary conditions.
Right.
So that extra scalar degree of freedom is not there in the quantum theory. It will classically look like.
Okay.
But just looking at the bulk action, it might be there.
Sure.
I mean, so that there's some hope that perhaps such a scenario
could be.
But if I can add a word of warning about the allowing the lapse function to be a function of space-time, I think that invites all kinds of difficulties with closing the constrained algebra. Because if you have a lapse function which is which doesn't enter with time derivatives, it's a space-time dependent function, then it does give you a fourth constraint in the action of the field. I spent months trying to sort out how to close the constraint algebra, and I think I have one scenario how to close the symmetry algebra of constraints, but it leads to a topological theory which has no local property name. So I think it is kind of important to stick to the minimal model or introduce some additional symmetries into the system with extra degrees of freedom. But if you insist on foliation preserving diffeomorphisms as your gate symmetry, then I think n should be restricted to be only a function of time, otherwise you don't have a closed constraint algebra.
This is why you introduced the Weyl symmetry. When you introduce the Weyl symmetry...
Well, the Weyl symmetry is one way of actually compensating for that. There might be other ways, like the extra billion U1 that I was mentioning in the talk, that's another way which leads to similar things. At the formal level, also conformal Weyl symmetry in 3 plus 1. If you have the z equals 3 theory, we know that the Cartan tensor square term is accidentally conformally invariant under these local Weyl transformations. Of course, difficulties will be that, as usual, these will be anomalous conformal symmetries, so you don't necessarily expect them to hold unless you have some really specific supermultiples or something canceling the conformal anomaly. But that's another way in which you can actually add an extra symmetry and have just two propagating polarizations. But here, in the minimal theory, which is not conformally invariant, I think it's important to restrict n to be only a function of time, otherwise the theory wants to be topological.
So that other constraint you generate is the equation of motion.
Yeah, it's the equation of motion.
It's the same thing.
Well, I mean, the strict Hilbert formulation, it's diffeo invariant, so we do have that form.
Have you looked at the Hamiltonian
constraint? No, you have a second class type of formation. That's what you're going to do, so it's not going to be a first class type of algebra.
So I think those guys in the paper, they found the extra constraint and showed it was an equation.
That's for the low energy limit, huh?
No, you don't
have
another
question. Is
there any other question? One more. If not, let's thank Paul again.